Okay, a bunch of announcements. So the list assignment is due today, so presumably you will return them. Then 9-10, which is I guess next Monday, right? That's when the homework one is due. And then these are longer term issues. Actually on 9-24, which is Monday, 2 weeks from now, I won't be in town. So there won't be a class on that day for sure. I normally don't like to have somebody else fill in for me because that never works out. You know, either because the continuity would be lost or you would like them better than me and so you won't any longer like my lecture. So either way, I'm worried about letting anybody else teach the class. So what I plan to do is to make up for that class I'll be missing. So I will have to, the way I plan to do normally is that we'll have a separate extra class where I would lecture and then those of you who are actually available at the time would show up and listen to the lecture. For those of you who can't make it, we would tape the lecture. We would actually have a video of it available and you can watch it. And in addition to the slides and the audio that already is there. Okay, so that's what I am planning to do. I haven't yet figured out what would be the best way, best time to do it. More likely than not, I mean, the way it should be done is that, you know, I'm likely to do it on a Friday so that those of you who missed the class can check out the video over the weekend and be ready for the next class, okay? Best scenario would have been to do it on a Friday before 9:24, but I won't be here on that day either, so I can't do it then. So it's going to be either this Friday or next Friday or the Friday after I come back, okay? But how many of you, just to give me an idea, how many of you are likely to be able to show up for Friday 10:40 to 11:55? I'm just trying to keep the same time. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, okay. So that's fine, that's what we'll do. So if there is small enough number of people, then what I would do is once I make the date, I'll let you guys know and we'll probably have the class, I mean, I'll tell you where the class is going to be too, okay. So that's the approximate point on that. Either way, definitely 9:24, you won't have a class, so you could be, you know, you could do something else during that time. Okay. So a bunch of things were being, let's see. So are there any questions on the stuff that we discussed last time? Do you remember what we discussed last time?
Searching graph.
So we were talking about iterative deepening depth first search and a couple of things that that came up at the end of the class was, is it really the case that iterative deepening depth first search would not be hugely worse than normal depth first and breadth first search? Okay. It definitely has space BD, branching factor times depth, because why does iterative deepening depth first search have space consumption B times D? What aspect of IDDFS makes sure that it will only take space B times D? See, normally algorithms come as packages, but there are pieces that to understand an algorithm, you should understand if I remove this part and put something else, what happens, okay? In the iterative deepening depth first search, there's the iteration, you go iteration by iteration, and then you also do depth first search during each iteration, okay? Mm-hmm. So which aspect gives you the B times D?
Space complexity is of a series of separate runs.
Yes,
is equal to the maximum run, and that one cannot be greater than the earlier one of BD. So
yeah, basically, because in each iteration, you're only doing depth first search. Okay? It's the depth first search aspect of it that gives you B times D. So in the blog, I asked a question, what if you were to replace depth first search and IDDFS with breadth first search? So it's something like IBDFS, IBDFS is a brain dead idea. Okay, you have to understand that, because if you were to do breadth first search in each iteration, you essentially have no use for what you're doing. It basically still has exponential phase and it takes more time, right? So it's a brain dead idea. So you have to understand that IBDFS is, you know, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Okay, so it's a depth first search within each iteration. In fact, if you ever need linear space anytime, linear space, then the only idea you know for linear space is depth first search. So whenever you need a linear space in some algorithm, throw in depth first search. We will see, you know, IDA star, which is a version of this, which uses A star ideas. It too uses depth first search for each iteration. Okay. The other issue, of course, is why is it optimal? It is optimal because it would, if it ever found a solution in depth D, it wouldn't have come to depth D unless it already exhausted everything up to depth D minus one, one depth by one depth. Okay, and so by definition, the first time it finds a solution, it found the optimal depth solution. Okay, in terms of the time complexity, it is in fact costlier than depth first search, because it does more, it's obvious that it does more expansions. At least on the uniform tree model, it does more expansions. Although in a minute we'll see that there can be cases, especially in a graph search, where IDDFS can do fewer expansions than depth first search. Why? Partly because depth first search can go into loops, whereas IDDFS won't go into loops because it goes iteration by iteration. Okay, so in fact, IDDFS on graph can actually be even better than DFS. But on uniform search trees, that is search trees where you have branching factor B and depth D everywhere. I mean, so branching factor B for every node and you go up to depth D. On that kind of a model, even on that kind of a model, IDDFS winds up doing only, essentially, it does, the first node is expanded D plus one times. The root node is expanded D plus one times. Okay, for zeroth depth, first depth, second depth, third depth, fourth depth, up to D depth. Okay, D plus one times. And then, so this node is expanded D plus one times. These two nodes are expanded D times. And then these nodes are expanded D minus one times and so on. Right? So that's the repetition that you're doing. But thankfully, the number of repetitions at most is D. Number of repetitions at most is D, right? Whereas the total number of nodes is B power D. Do you understand what I'm saying? So you could have done repetition in a much worse way. You could have repeated by doing the first node once, and then doing first and second node once, first, second, and third node once, first, second, third, fourth node once, and so on. That's the worst possible way of doing repetition. If you do that, then in fact, iterative deepening, those kinds of iterations would be much more than D. They can be as many as B power D iterations. Okay, if you do B power D iterations, you die. And in fact, keep this in mind, when we look at IDA star, we'll notice that in fact it's possible to do B power D iterations in IDA star under certain cases. Okay, but since depth first search only expands, the iterations are defined in terms of depth. Depths are integral. So, zero depth, one depth, two depth, three depth, and so on. Every time you increase the depth, you are bringing in a whole slew of nodes into consideration, right? The entire fringe at ith level is being brought in for consideration, okay? So that's ultimately the reason why, so if you add this up, essentially it's still of the order of B power D. So in the worst case, it's still of the order of B power D, and you know that depth first search is also of the order of B power D, and if you actually do the math, if you take the average number of nodes expanded by IDDFS divided by the average number of nodes expanded by depth first search, okay, and you simplify that expression asymptotically for large values of B, you would get the ratio B plus 1 by B minus 1. So that's essentially the ratio, okay? So IDDFS does B plus 1 by B minus 1 nodes, B plus 1 by B minus 1 more expansions than the depth first search. Okay? For large values of B, this is close to be this is going to be close to 1. Okay? For b equal to 1, this expression doesn't make any sense. Right? If b equal to 1, then it will actually be 0. So in fact, you say for b equal to 1, you know, IDDFS does infinite number of more expansions than depth first. It's not as bad. It does do pretty many, because as I said last time, there's a homework question for this. IDDFS does, you know, if b equal to 1, essentially, you have all the nodes in a straight line, basically. It's not a tree, it's a line. Okay? In that case, every iteration brings in exactly one extra node. Okay? And IDDFS is, in fact, much worse than b plus 1 by b minus 1, but it's not infinitely worse. Okay? Any other questions on IDDFS? One thing that you do want to keep in mind is you right now have, this is something that, you know, is interesting to note, that you have algorithms which can take order b power d space, or you have algorithms which take order b times d space. That's a huge spectrum. There's only 2 points in the spectrum that you have available. Okay? You may not have as much memory as this, but you may have much more memory than this. Okay? A question would be, if I have more memory than this, but less memory than this, could I use that memory to do, you know, reduce the number of repeated expansions? Okay? And in fact, that's a very reasonable idea. And there are many good algorithms, the variations of IDDFS, things like SMA star that are, we may or may not discuss in the class, but it's kind of briefly discussed in the textbook. Essentially, what you would do in those scenarios is that you would let the search tree take over the space until you're about to fill up the space. And then you throw some bad guys out to make space for the new guys. That's the way you wind up making sure that you use as much memory as is available. And so when you do that, SMA star kind of ideas will do better than IDDFS because they do lesser number of repeated expansions. Okay? But all of this is about memory and how to write a search algorithm such that it will use less memory or just the amount of memory that you have. Okay? None of these are changing the time because time complexity can still be quite high. They're all almost the same time complexity. Okay? Okay. By the way, so here is a graph just to give you an idea. You know, you should understand that if you have a graph like this, okay, and if you do BFS on this, you should first you would expand A first, then you would expand B, then you would expand G. And G, I put a circle around G, G is supposed to be the goal node. Okay? Goal state. So what you would have done is you would expanded A, then B, then G, and you would have stopped if you're doing breadth first search. By the way, in normal convention is that in the same level, you go from left to right. Okay? But there is really no big difference between what is left, what is right. You know, the only guarantee that BFS has is you would never have expanded a depth 5 node without having expanded all the depth 4 nodes. That's the only guarantee that you have. Okay, so that's for the breadth first. What would DFS have done? DFS would have expanded A, then you would have got B and G onto the queue, then it would have expanded B, then it would have got C onto the queue, it would have expanded C, it would have got D onto the queue, it would have expanded G, and it would have stopped. That's what depth first search would have done. And so it would have expanded A, B, C, D, G. So the total number of expansions for this is 3. And you assume that the goal node, when you pick it for expansion, you stop, you count it as an expansion normally. Okay? So you have total number of expansions here is 3. Here it is 5. Yes, there was a question.
Yeah, it looks like a case where, would you say that's a case where some of the, not only the shape of the problem, but the small size of the problem, the constants inherent in the big O notation sort of taking over and giving you better results with the DFS, or is it?
Yeah, so this is, see, the big O notation stuff was doing 2 different things. First of all, it's doing asymptotic analysis for large Bs, and second of all, and much more importantly, it is doing it's assuming uniform tree model. Is this a uniform tree? No, because this guy has branching factor 2, this guy has only branching factor 1, 1, 1. So you did the analysis for a uniform tree, but just to get an idea, but you know, you should be able to handle any type of graph or tree that's thrown to you. Okay. So finally, what about IDDFS? Actually, let me show it in this. This you can go back and look at it more carefully. If you the way I would really like you to think of doing search on paper to make sure that you understand the difference between nodes and states is to actually make up nodes. Okay, so I would have done, for example, the depth first search. Let me just do it for IDDFS. Okay, so IDDFS would start in this graph and it makes a node N1 corresponding to A. Okay, and now at the first iteration, the depth is set to 0. So then when it tries to expand A, it fails right away. Even though A has children, when you set depth equal to 0, that means no child who is more than depth 0 would ever come in. So it's as good as a dead child. Okay. So then you have just this tree, and this is searched by the depth first search. And so it will put N1A into the queue, it will remove N1A from the queue, check if it is a goal node. It is not, so it stops. So that iteration is over. Now the second iteration starts. When the second iteration starts, actually you would then put a N1A back in. In fact, you can even call it N2A because it's a new node now, except for the same state. Okay. So N1A, and then it expands to get N2 and N3, but when you expand N2, you would fail because you can't go farther than N2 because depth is 1 now. Okay. So in a way, actually, what IDDFS does, if you're writing the algorithm, what you would do is you would just put the depth limit into the child generator function. So if the child generator function takes the depth limit, and automatically if the depth limit is more than the current child depth, it would just return nil. That's what it would do. Okay. So in a way, you would start from here, and then you would expand this node first. And when you try to expand it further, you fail, so there are no children, so you would automatically backtrack and expand this node. When you pick this node for expansion, it will be a goal node, and you stop. Yes, question.
So basically, there's a tag on each node that it's expanded or is looking at, saying what the current depth of the node is, if you're thinking of the data structure.
Yeah. See, because remember, I don't have this right now, but we had a slide which had the node data structure. The node data structure has a bunch of fields. It has the state field, which has a pointer to the actual state, and it has a depth field, and it has a G field, which is the total amount of distance from the root node. I mean, total amount of cost from the root node. And it can also have a parent pointer, so that if you stop with this node, you can find the parent, find the path, and reverse it so that you know the actual path you took. Okay? Now notice in this, and there was another question.
So that means that every iteration
you're expanding the node again? Yes, that was the whole point. No, but that was the whole point. We went through this whole thing. I mean, so you need to understand this. There you are expanding, IDDFS is expanding more nodes than depth first search in the uniform tree model. It does expand more nodes, but if you consider the asymptotic analysis, the ratio is only b plus 1 by b minus 1. So the total, so you know, if you have b equal to 5, then it does 6 by 4 number of nodes more than what DFS does. Okay, but it gives you optimality and it gives you linear space. So you don't get something out of nothing. You're giving up space, you're giving up time to improve optimality, essentially.
Then it depends on the kind of graph.
That was the point. Again, you know, keep this back in your mind as to, so for example, in the blog there was a question as to what if you have problems where all the goals are in the final level. So if you have a tree of depth D, and I don't know where the goals are in this tree, but I know that all of them are at the depth D. None above depth D. So the question is, should you do BDS, breadth-first search, depth-first search, or iterative deepening search on that kind of a graph? What?
Depth-first.
What about breadth-first? Does it make sense? It's a dumb idea. It's not only not make sense, it's a dumb idea to do breadth-first search when I already told you. Like, for example, I'm telling you, until you go 100 feet from here, so I put in like a diamond, and I tell you, it's 100 feet from here somewhere. And then you start looking very carefully here. That's stupid. That's extremely stupid. You should go 100 feet, concentric circle from here 100 feet, and in that circle look around it. Right? How about IDDFS? It's even more sophisticated idea. Would IDDFS make sense to use in this kind of a scenario? When I tell you the diamond is 100 feet from here, would it make sense to not only look here as well as look here? Look here as well as look here. That's like doubly dumb. I mean, in fact, D times dumb. Right? So IDDFS is like the dumbest idea to use if you know that all the goal nodes are in the depth D. That's why you should keep awake and see when what algorithm makes sense when. Okay? It only makes sense when, in fact, goals can be at different depths. I also asked in the blog, can you think of problems where all goals wind up being at the same depth? And there are many, many such problems. And in fact, you know, I pointed that out in the blog answer yesterday, but you can go back and look at it, and we'll also look at it later on. Many problems such as traveling salesperson problem, where you are supposed to find the shortest circuit which goes from one city to another, visits each city exactly once, and does the shortest circuit, shortest distance traveled. In such a case, ultimately, you have to see all the cities. And so the depth of the solution is always the same. For example, the costs of different solutions are different. The depth is the same. And if you think of N queens problem, which is you have N by N chessboard, and so 8 by 8 chessboard, and you are trying to put 8 queens on the chessboard such that no pair of queens would conflict with each other. That's a classic case where ultimately all 8 queens need homes. It's not enough to have homes for just 7 of them. So all solutions are at depth 8. Okay? Sudoku puzzle is again a similar scenario. All solutions are at a depth, at the same depth. And finally, in general, satisfiability problems of any kind, where I have a whole bunch of Boolean formulas and I'm trying to find truth falsity values for propositions such that all Boolean formulas would be satisfied. That too would be fixed depth. All solutions would be at the same depth. If there are n propositions, all solutions would be at the depth n. In all these cases, you have to be dumber than usual to use breadth first or IDDFS. Because all solutions are at the same depth, and they're all equally good. Except in traveling salesperson, where depth is not equal to cost. So it's a different issue there. But in N queens problem and in satisfiability problem, all solutions are created equal. They're all at the same depth. So you just use depth first search. Okay? So in this particular case, by the way, if you notice, in this case, BFS did 3 expansions, DFS did 5, and IDDFS only did 4 in this particular graph. So in fact, even though it repeated expanded, it expanded repeatedly in some cases, it still did better than DFS. And in fact, I can, with loops in the graph, I can do arbitrarily better compared to DFS. That's, I think, the next example. Okay, consider this example. The only difference between this example and the previous example is here, A has a child B, B doesn't have A as a child. So if you expand A, you get B, but if you expand B, you don't get A back in this case. Okay? Whereas in the next case, B has child A has child B. So it's an undirected graph. That means B, if you expand B, you can get A back. Okay, this is a graph too. And if you are doing search on this, what do you think will happen? If you're doing search on this, breadth first search would start with A, okay, the node corresponding to A, and then expand it to get B and G, then expand B to get A and C back, but then it'll keep them in Q and look at G and say G is my goal, so it stops. So it only expanded three nodes. Okay? What about depth first search? It expands A, gets B and G, then it expands B, gets A and C, so then it expands A, gets B and G, then expands B, gets A and C, and it just keeps doing this. Loop, loop, loop. So it is repeatedly expanding A, B, A, B, A, B, A, B, many, many number of times, you know, until it just dies. Okay? IDDFS, on the other hand, and of course in this particular case, DFS fails. It doesn't even find the goal because it goes into a loop. It will just never find the goal. Okay? IDDFS, on the other hand, would expand A, then it will get, in the first iteration, it doesn't find the goal, then it expands, it basically considers this node, A, B, G, right? And then it expands A, expands B, expands G, and stops. Yes? Because it's just, what it's doing is it's essentially putting stuff into the queue, right? In the beginning, you had N1A into the queue, it removed it and expanded it, right? So when it expanded it, it got N2B, N3G, right? Now you remove N2B, you would again get, when you remove N2B, you get N4A and N5G. I'm sorry, N5C. So there is a goal on the queue, but you'll never get to it because primogeniture, all the losers who get born would have to be taken care of before any winner who is already alive will ever be, you know, brought forth. Right? So that's exactly what IDDFS does. And so in this particular case, actually, IDDFS, so here is another useful thing for IDDFS. Depth first search does take linear space, but it's not only not optimal, it's not complete. So even for a fixed size graph, even for a finite graph, if the graph has cycles, depth first search can do arbitrarily badly because of all these cycles. Okay? Now, the question then is, since you know, it looks like there is this problem about cycles. Depth first search gets into loops. Now, the loops are also a problem for breadth first search, except breadth first search will ultimately get out of the loops. Because even if the loop branch is infinitely long, if the goal is at a finite depth, then every finite depth goal has to be expanded before any infinitely deep goal is considered. And so, breadth first search will stop, even though it does do some repeated expansion because of the looping. Depth first, on the other hand, just dies, falls flat on the face. Okay? So if you just consider the issue of looping during search, when you're doing search on the graphs, you can do looping. How can you stop looping? Okay? Basically, as I said, repeated expansion is a problem, a big issue for DFS, but it's also an issue for BFS. It's also an issue for IDDFS. They're just able to get out of it because they don't go deeper, and arbitrarily deeper before looking at the finite depth. Okay? Now, if you do want to cut down the looping, the effect of looping, right, and improve the search further, some ideas are there. So one idea, of course, is the simplest idea is to remember every state that has been expanded once. Every state. Okay? And look at, keep a list of states that have been already expanded. And before expanding any node, you see if the state corresponding to that node is already on the closed list, which is the list of nodes that have already been expanded, a list of states that have been expanded. Okay? So until now, we only had one queue, right, which is a search queue. And search queue is also called open list. It's a list of all nodes that are awaiting their expansion. Okay? But to stop looping, you might consider having one more data structure called the closed list. Open list contains nodes, closed list contains states. Not nodes, but states. Because it doesn't matter how many times A comes into the search with different node identities. If it's been expanded once, there's no point in expanding it again because its children are not going to change just because the, you know, The way you got to A has changed. So closed list contains states, open list contains nodes. Before you expand any node on the open list, you check if its state is present on the closed list. And if so, you stop expanding it. If you do this, you'll cut all the looping. The problem then is, what are you giving up to stop the looping?
The space
and the duplicate check. Two things, space and the duplicate check. Don't assume, so first of all, space. The closed list can become as big as the size of the graph. So you can be saying, I'm depth first, I give linear space memory. But I have a closed list, which takes exponential space because it's storing the entire graph. So basically, the fact that I'm linear space is of no use to anybody because I have this other part of my same code which actually keeps an exponentially large data structure. Okay? So you can, at the worst case, have the entire graph stored in the closed list, so you wind up taking too much space. And the other issue is duplicate checking. It's not easy to know that the state that you have in front is equal to a state that you have looked at previously. Okay? You may think that's easy enough if states come with names like A, B, C, D, because then you can check whether A is present on the list or not. What if states happen to be subgraphs of a graph? And you're trying to find the best subgraph of a graph. So then you are trying to compare one subgraph here to another subgraph there to see if they're isomorphic. That's a pretty darn costly operation. Subgraph isomorphism, for the longest time was on the border between tractable and intractable. Okay? So in general, duplicate check can be quite costly too. So it looks like a great idea, but by doing it, you have given up both the time and the space. Yes? It depends on, so hashing is not, ultimately what hashing is going to do is it needs to take a state and find a good hashing structure such that when it hashes to the same thing, you definitely are duplicate. If you cannot solve subgraph isomorphism by simple hashing, it has to be a harder hashing because the complexity doesn't go away. What you could do, however, is you could say, when I say it's a duplicate, it definitely is a duplicate. When I say it's not a duplicate, it may still be a duplicate. So I can have an approximate hashing, which when it signals duplicate, it definitely is a duplicate. But it might miss some duplicates. Such an idea is good enough for us, because it will at least cut down some duplicate expansion while keeping the others floating, okay? Which is exactly the kind of idea we're talking about here. So you can do partial reduction, which winds up having good trade-off in terms of memory and time, by rather than keeping all the nodes on a separate data structure called closed list, okay? What I might do is, the simplest idea would be, when I expand, so in this particular case, all I needed to do is, when I expanded B, I got A, right? I just had to make sure that A was not already a parent of B. In this case, A was a parent of B, and you expanded B, and you got A. So my child is the same as my parent. That's the simplest loop that happened here. If you stop that, at least you would have stopped some of the loops. Not all, but some of the loops.
So was that test only checking direct parents? Or
exactly. So the simplest, what I would do here, if I just do this, all I would have done is I check whether any of my children are the same as my parent. So parent is a single node, which corresponds to a single state. I just check if any of my children are the same as my parent. So as long as I'm not regressing back to my own parent, I say it's fine. But clearly, that idea would, if it says something is a duplicate, it's a duplicate. If it doesn't say something is a duplicate, it may still be a duplicate, because maybe you're not regressing to your parent, but you're regressing to your grandparent. You're regressing to your great-grandparent. Okay? Just a second. A better idea would then be so this is the cheapest idea, cheapest to implement, but it would not cut down all the looping. Okay? And this idea is slightly better, which essentially says, check if my child is the same as any of my ancestors, any of my direct ancestors. Now, if you are a depth D node, you have exactly D ancestors. Your parent, next previous level, that guy's parent, that guy's parent, that guy's parent, until the root node. So you're only making comparisons to D nodes. Here you're making comparisons to just one node. Here you're making comparisons only to D nodes. So number of children times D nodes, okay, is the comparisons that you're doing. Plus, you're not keeping track of any extra nodes anywhere. There's no closed list because ancestors are available just because of the pointers in the nodes. Okay? And this winds up being the sweet spot, actually. If you say this one is a superset of this, right? So this will capture all the duplicates this guy will capture. The question is this enough to capture all possible duplicates? No. Because I may not be any of my ancestors, but I am one of my great-grand uncles. Right? I'm not my grandparent, my great-grandparent, etc., but I'm one of my great-grand uncles who is in a different path, but above me. I didn't check that duplicate. So I would still be re-expanding in that case. But in practice, this winds up being a good idea that winds up doing a good trade-off between time and space.
Now, in a graph where you don't have a single parent, when you say ancestor, you just mean the ancestor of that given traversal?
In the search tree, you always have a single parent. It does not matter what the graph says. In the search tree, because you came into this world because a particular node was expanded. So the node's parent, it's such a very good question, by the way. These are the kinds of questions you should think. Because later on, they can cause confusion when you're writing the program. During the search tree, you know, each node has an unique parent. A state may have multiple possible parents because of the graph. Okay? There was some raised hand somewhere. Yes?
So the main problem here with not just keeping names, are you just like looking at graphs where the nodes don't have names and the only thing you have is what you've expanded so far and kind of pointers to it?
Yeah.
But you have locations, but that's all you have to go with.
Yeah. So nodes normally don't have names. Nodes are a data structure.
Couldn't you use the location directly as a name? And
what location?
Oh, well.
The memory location.
Yeah.
No, because the thing is, suppose, so think of 8 puzzles. Right?
Oh, okay.
Right? Any configuration which has the same tiles in the same places is the same state. But if I make 2 arrays which both have exact same configuration, the arrays won't be equal. You have to do actual, so that they won't be pointer equal. Okay? To check that 2 arrays are equal, you actually have to do element by element comparison, which is costlier than just saying the pointer is the same. Okay? So in general, it's easy enough to see that the space can become exponential. Normally, it's not as easy to see that duplicate check itself can be quite costly, depending on the data structure that you have. Okay?
So you're just trying to make sure you're not getting into a completely equivalent state. For example, if you slide the back, the block this way, and then back.
You'll get to the same exact state.
And they will initially be in different memory locations, but
But you'll check equality. Right, exactly. Okay, so that's all about depth, you know, the blind searches and how to deal with repetition because of the graph. And we also learned that IDDFS is not as losing an idea as you thought it was. In fact, it can wind up doing better than depth first search when you have loops. Okay, if you didn't have this idea thrown in. Okay, now we will start talking about differentiating between the depth and the cost. There's no real reason why the goodness of a goal is connected to its depth. It's not the number of flights you take to go from here to some place, but it's the price you pay for each of the flights and the time each of those flights takes that matters. Right? So rather than think of the depth, you want to think in terms of the cost. Okay? So the idea then would be, instead of thinking of general directed or undirected graphs, you think of weighted graphs. From your data structure terminology. A weighted graph is a graph. It could be depth, DAG, or it could be directed or undirected. But it has weights on the edges. Okay? So here is A, and A is 1 away from B, B is 1 away from C, C is 1 away from D, D is 2 away from G. And A is also 9 away from G on this road. You know, it's easy to think of them now, not this graph, as roads, you know, cities and roads. Okay, so this, there is a way, it's a one costly road, two costly road, and there is also like an expressway where you probably pay a lot of money, but it's 9 costly. Right? The question then is, so this is a reasonable problem, right? Everything else remains the same. All that changed is that you have costs on the edges. The question is, do any of the ideas that we have seen till now, are they optimal on this? Is obviously, if they are inoptimal to begin with, right, they were not going to be inoptimal. They will still be inoptimal now. So the only question is, who were optimal to begin with, and see if they are still optimal now. What are the two search algorithms that we know that were optimal for non-weighted graphs? Yes, so breadth first and iterative deepening depth first search. Let's look at breadth first. Would breadth first be optimal here? No. Because it essentially, it cannot be optimal as long as you wind up, you know, sorting nodes in terms of their depth on the queue. So one way of thinking of breadth first search is to say that it's putting all the nodes onto the queue and it's giving for each node a priority. The priority of the node is equal to its depth from the root node. And the lower, so the smaller the numbers, the higher the priority. And it will always pick nodes, it will resort the queue at every time in terms of the priority, and pick the one with the highest priority, which is the lowest depth. That's what breadth first search is doing. If you think of that way of breadth first search, then there is a variation which should work, which could work potentially, which is worth checking, which is instead of prioritizing in terms of depth, why not prioritize in terms of the cost of reaching, the cost to reach this node from the root node. Not the depth, but the cost. So for example, when you are in the beginning, A has zero depth and it has zero cost too. When A has been expanded and you got B and G, B has depth 1 and cost 1, because 0 plus 1. Okay? G has depth 1 but cost 9. Okay? Basically, the cost of a node, it's called its G value. G value of a node is equal to G value of the parent of that node plus the cost of the edge from parent of that node to the node. That's all I'm doing here. Okay, pretty straightforward idea. So if I prioritize the queue in terms of the G values, would I be optimal? Yes. What? What this definition? So G of the node N is the G value of the parent, which is the cost to reach the parent, plus the cost to go from the parent to me on this particular edge.
Okay, but you need to calculate the cost of the parent.
Yeah, but it's repeatedly calculated. Cost of the root node is zero. Cost of every other node is, you know, every node below the root node has been recursively calculated in terms of that. So you always have G of, in fact, you can say depth itself is recursively calculated. You don't know where, what the depth of a node is. In fact, D of N is exactly the same formula, except it is updated. So whereas D of N is D of parent of N plus 1. That's all, you know. So you always add 1. Okay, here you are adding actually different numbers based on the edge cost. That's it. Okay, now the edge costs in general are any real numbers. They don't have to be integers. We'll see, you know, how far can we push this any real number idea. Yes. What? Positive? We keep that in mind. We'll see whether it's required. If it's not required, we will not do it. You may know why they must be positive, but let's wait for a second. Okay? So edge costs are supposed to be real numbers. That's what we had in mind. Okay? So these are real numbers. Let's do the expansion here. So you start with a equal to 0, I mean n0, which is a, has the g value 0. You expanded it, n1, which is b, n2 is g, and this is 1, this is 9. So on the open list, you have these two prioritized such that this comes first, this comes next. Right? So you expand b, and you'll get n3, which is c. Okay? And by the way, in this particular case, b can only come back to c, it cannot go back to a. Suppose the graph was such that it was an undirected graph. What would have happened is, here you'd have gotten an n4, which is again a. But now this a has a different cast. This a has 0 cast, this a would be 2 cast. It's the same in the depth too. This a would be a different depth, and right? So in fact, even when there are cycles, the g value for the same state keeps changing. Okay? So in this case, only c was its child, and so you got that, and then you expanded c, you got d, and you expanded d, you got g, and you expanded g, and you stopped. In this case, in this graph, it was clear that this is the best path, because this is what? 5 cast path, whereas another way of coming, any other way of coming here, in this case, there's only one other way of coming, that's larger than 5. It would be 9 in this case.
How would it work if this were undirected and it didn't have heuristics to prevent
leaks? There is no heuristics right now. Do we have any heuristics right now, first of all? No. So if you have actual cycles, let's see what happens if you have cycles. Tell me what happens if you have cycles. So you would start with A, N1A, which is 0, and then you would get N2B as part of the deal, which is 1, and then you would get N3A, which is 2, and N4C, which is also 2. So you would be unlucky and you would expand this, because, you know, by convention you may have expanded this, you know.
Is it a depth-first approach?
No, you're doing prioritized queue. Prioritized queue means of the so there is also N2-G, which has cost 9. So on the search queue, you have a 2, a 2, and a 9. You pick any of the 2s and expand it, because they are better than the 9. So, yeah, so lowest first. So you pick this, let's say, just to see how bad things can get. You pick this, you would then get B again, N4B, N5B, which is now 3, no. This is 0, this is 1, 2, 3. N4B is 3, okay? And N5B and N6 is G. N6 is G, which is how much? 2 plus 9, 11. So there is a better way of going to G. You didn't realize this, which is, go first this side, I mean, not better, another way at least. You go first this side, go back, and go to G. Thankfully, if the world has any sense, this cannot be better than the previous node. But in fact, you get it just by the numbers, because, you know, so A is 2 plus 9, it's 11. So now the nodes on the queue, there's a 3, there's a 11, there is a 2, there is a 9. So you would expand this. You see, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. You may expand some nodes more than, you know, some bad nodes, but ultimately you would have to reach any finite depth. Okay? That's what saves. Basically, by the way, this version of breadth first search, for reasons that are mind-boggling, is called uniform cost search. It's a totally oxymoronic name. So that's the best way to remember this, because in the literature it's called uniform cost search. There's nothing uniform in this, right? All the costs are actually non-uniform. But it's, the name is uniform cost search. Yes. Yes. So you may have heard of it as the Dijkstra's algorithm, you know, with a little change. But basically, you can think of this as prioritized search, where the priority is defined in terms of the cost to the node, the G value to the node. Okay, and breadth first is a prioritized algorithm where the priority is defined in terms of the depth to the node. Depth first is also a prioritized search where the priority is defined in terms of the negation of the depth. So a big number minus depth is your priority, or negative of the depth is your priority, so that the deeper nodes get expanded first. So you know, you can actually write one little algorithm which just does prioritized queuing, and that would work for all these guys just based on what the priority is. Okay, except depending on the way you define the priority, you may be optimal, you may be inoptimal. Breadth first and uniform cost search are, in this case at least, it's optimal, but we'll see whether or not it really can be probably optimal. Yes.
So all the edge weights were to be say one equal and positive, that would be equivalent to breadth first and
yes, if all the edge weights are uniform, then it's basically doing the exact same thing as breadth first search.
And if they're all negative one, would it be the same as depth first?
We will see what happens to negative in a second. In fact, negatives make no sense in this search. You know, we'll see that in a minute. Okay. So let's think about properties of this. Is this complete? Why? How do I argue the completeness? Let's see. Oh, wait. Okay, let's argue the completeness. This is the proof. Okay, and there are many, many ways of proving it, but let's do it this way so that you will know how to generally prove optimality of an algorithm which does prioritized queuing. Okay, so here is the way the argument goes. This is the root node N0, and the uniform cost search ended with a node N and said this is the goal node. It stopped because at that point when it picked N for expansion, it succeeded with the goal test and it said this is the goal node. You're not going to question whether or not it's a goal node. If goal test says it's a goal node, it's a goal node. What you can question is it the optimal goal node? Is it the goal node with the lowest G value? How do you prove that it is going to be the node with the lowest G value? The way you can prove it essentially is, basically suppose what you are hoping that is that if there is any other goal node, N dash, let's say, that means N dash also would succeed for the goal test, okay? It better be the case that G of N dash should be what compared to G of N? G of N dash should be greater than G of N. That's what you want. Let's try to assume that's not the case. Let's assume that G of N dash is actually less than, strictly less than G of N. If it is less, then your search algorithm is not optimal, right? What I would prove now is if I start with this assumption A1, then using the rest of the way, using the theory of the way this particular priority queue works, I'll derive a contradiction. And so by proof by contradiction, I say this can't be possible. Okay? So the way you could do it essentially is to say, well, this is fine. This is an assumption. The next question is, look, why did you pick up N? If in fact N was picked up before N dash, and they both were in the search queue at the same time, then it must have been the case that G of N is less than G of N dash, right? So clearly, if both of them were in the search queue at the same time, then this wouldn't have been possible. Because your search algorithm wouldn't have picked N instead of N dash if both were present together, if this guy has a lower G value than this guy. The fact that you picked this means, in fact, your assumption is wrong. That's case one. So in case one, you're done. What's the case two? Case two, N and N dash were not present in the search queue at the same time. Somehow N dash is a stealth candidate. It was a stealth goal. It was waiting around, not ever being present on the queue along with N. So you picked N when N dash wasn't there, but then later on N dash show up and said, look, I'm optimal. And so you feel sad. Okay. The question is, if N dash is not present on the queue when N was picked, some ancestor of N dash must have been present on the queue. This is the important insight. It's okay for N dash not to be present on the queue when N was picked. If it was present, it wouldn't have been, N wouldn't have been picked at all. Okay? If n dash was not present, then some ancestor n double dash was present with n. Now, given the way search works, it must then have been the case that g of n is less than r equal to g of n double dash, right? Because otherwise, if these two guys were present on the search queue at the same time, you wouldn't have picked this unless this is equally good or better than this. So what in essence I'm saying is the partial path to a non-goal node here is already worse than a complete path to a goal node. This is a classic case of a bird in hand is worth multiple birds, worth more than multiple birds in the bush. Okay, there are various birds that could be hanging around in this bush, right? But you already have a bird in the hand, which is actually cheaper. So the question then is, if the partial path here is already costlier than this, is it possible that the completed path would actually become cheaper than this? When would it not become cheaper? That's exactly where you must have the case that the costs are positive. If they are negative, if the edge costs are negative, then by doing more and more distances, you get better and better costs. Right? So this is the reason why it must be the case that all the edge costs must be positive. In fact, all it requires is that the edge costs must be greater than or equal to 0. That's what, for this proof to proceed, the edge cost must be greater than or equal to 0. Then the other question is, if it is equal to 0, then you may not terminate. If you terminate, you would be optimal, but if you don't, you may not terminate at all, because there are many, many zero cost paths and you keep expanding them. So uniform cost search is optimal as long as there exists an epsilon, a positive number epsilon, such that every edge cost is greater than epsilon, or greater than or equal to epsilon. Then uniform cost search is optimal. Otherwise, it's not. Okay? But in general, the argument we made here is the partial path to this goal node through n double dash is already worse than a complete path through this goal node. So how can it be that this would be better than this? That's the argument we made. Okay? Question on this. So this particular argument holds only because the distances are always greater than or equal to 0. Okay? Yes?
So part of the expansion is
checked
if
it's still in
your goal node also?
Yes. No. Anytime you pick a node for expansion, you check if it's a goal node. Okay? Good. Okay. So another way of looking at what happens in breadth first search. So that is the proof. That's like a watertight proof as to why uniform cost search is optimal. And you will keep this in mind, because when we come to A star search, I'll use the exact same picture and prove that A star search is optimal with very little difference to the proof. Okay. Ultimately, the question is, if a partial path currently is worse than a complete path, then there is no point in expanding that partial path. That's the idea. Until the partial paths become as good as the complete path, you would not pick the complete path. This is why you can't stop just because the goal node came onto the queue. You have to wait for the goal node to percolate up such that it is the best path among all the paths, including the partial ones. Okay? Even if there is a partial path which is little less than goal node, you can't stop. You have to first expand that before you expand this. Okay. Another way of thinking of what breadth first search is doing, uniform cost search is doing, is that it starts from this, whatever point you're starting from, start node, and essentially searching in concentric circles, where the radius of the circle is equal to the distance to which you're looking. Okay? Can I do iterative deepening version of this search? Can I do iterative deepening version of this search? Yeah. But I cannot do the iterations in terms of depth. I have to do iterations in terms of cost. So the textbook doesn't have it. The textbook has IDDFS and it has something called IDA star. But you can have IDUC, iterative deepening uniform cost search. Okay? All you wind up doing is here the iteration is in terms of dn. So you put a limit on the depth. When dn is less than, first the limit dn equal to, let's say, 0. And then any node which has, let's say, depth 1, so any node whose depth is less than 1 would be allowed to come in. When it becomes 2, then any node which has depth less than 2 would be allowed to come in. Okay? To do the iterative deepening uniform cost search, you do iteration is in terms of g of n. Instead of d of n, you use g of n. Right? So you put a limit on the g, and during the expansion, you know every child node's current g value, right? As soon as you expand the child, you know its g value, because you know the parent's g value, you know the cost of the age, so you know the child's g value. If the child's g value is higher than the limit, then you say it doesn't exist. What this allows is I could have a node, let's say n, which has three children, let's say a node A, which has three children B, C, and D. B would be worse than the g limit, but C and D can get through. What that means then, just a second, what that means is that when you look at the search tree, right, the depth first search, IDDFS was going like this. Uniform cost search, the g-based thing, can be anything. It can be this first, this next, that next, that next. Okay? You have basically the iteration has nothing to do with the depth. In each of the iterations, what search would you do? In each of the iterations, what search would you do? Depth first. Because the only reason you do iterative anything is to improve the space. And uniform cost search is the same as basically the breadth first search. So its cost, its space consumption is exponential. Whereas if you do iterative deepening uniform cost search, its space consumption would be linear. Yes? How do you increase the limit? How do you increase the limit? Exactly. How do you allow, if you're a bouncer at the club, right, and you're allowing people of a certain limit of attractiveness in, and various people coming in, and when the club isn't full, then you increase, lower the attractiveness threshold and let them in too. So the question is, which of the people would start letting in? You know, you'll remember the people who are hanging around, who were below the attractiveness threshold previously, and take the guy with the highest attractiveness, which was below the previous attractiveness threshold, let him in or her in. That's exactly what you do here. The problem then is if attractiveness is not integral, it can be decimal, then each iteration you will be letting in one person at a time. So the number of iterations of iterative deepening uniform cost search is going to be how many in the worst case?
Size of the graph.
Traded on bad. Okay? If on the other hand the edge costs are integral, then basically there are only certain quantized attractiveness that is available. And so whenever you say, oh, now four level attractive nodes are being let in, whole bunch of nodes will get in. The more guys can get in per iteration, the fewer the number of iterations you have to do. Okay? Okay, so it's optimal and it's not efficient, because breadth first search is inefficient And I mean, so basically, it's going to do, in the worst case, b power d number of nodes expanded. Okay. To see this, look at, and then one other thing before we talk about efficiency, what about the space? Uniform cost search, the space is exponential. But you have iterative deepening uniform cost search whose space is linear. Okay? Then the last question is efficiency. Is it any better than blind searches, the depth first search and so on? It looked like in this case it was okay, but consider this graph, a slightly different graph. In this case, I call it a bait and switch graph because here what happened was the path that started looking initially promising was also the path that was finally the most promising path. Right? The way you can kill uniform cost search is to make some paths look uniform, you know, initially promising, and then much later when you come, you know, keep going with them, you'll find that they're actually not promising at all. Something, and then you have to shift over to something else. Okay, so for example, consider the same graph except with differing numbers. Okay, 0.1, 0.1, 0.1, 25, 19. Then what happens is you would keep expanding this, then this, then this, then this, oops, this is too costly, so then you go back. I can add like about a million of these nodes here, you know, with 0.00001 cost each, as long as they are positive. And, you know, uniform cost search will expand each of those nodes painfully before coming back to the right path. That is blindness, because you only know exactly what you're looking in front of you. All blind searchers know how long they have traveled. They don't care about how much they're going to travel. It's not surprising. We're all blind in the way we do decision making, right? I mean, you know, all of you, I mean, some of you might be following the subprime crisis, subprime mortgage crisis, and part of the issue there was many, many people took loans which have this exactly bait and switch tactic built in. Okay, so you would wind up taking a mortgage loan where in the initial years the interest would be very low. So you feel good. But then they tell you that some number of years later the interest will skyrocket. And you say, yeah, that's too many years later. Hopefully I'll sell my house and get out. And then if you didn't sell your house and get out, you start actually paying large amount of interest. So initially there may have been two loans. One is fixed interest loan, which looks much worse than this one, which has much lower in the beginning, much higher in the later. And so you will start following this and pay for it because it was a misleading path that you took. Okay? And these are exactly these costs on the edges were essentially telling you how far you have traveled. And the other piece that matters in deciding optimal path is what? To make optimal path, you do need to know how far you have already traveled. So for example, if there are two paths, on this path you have already traveled 2 miles, on this path you have only traveled 1 mile, clearly this is better looking right now. That much I can tell. But that's only partial piece of information. What else do I need to know? I need to know how far am I going to have to travel on this path to get to the nearest goal, and how far am I going to have to travel on this node to get to the nearest goal. Okay? So you not only need to know how far you came from the root node, but you need to know how far away you are from the goal node. If I tell you exactly how far you are from the closest goal node, search is child's play. Suppose I were to tell you for each of these nodes, right, when you are at B, I tell you, well, if you are here, the best path from B, by the way, you can look at this, right? So what's the best path from B to the goal node?
25.2.
Given this branch, because you can't go back, so it's 25.2. And whereas this G, the best path from G to G is how much?
Zero.
So the total cost of the path from B to G is 0.1 plus 25.2, which is 25.3. And this is 9 plus 0, which is 9. All of a sudden, this guy starts looking more interesting. So you expand this guy first. If I were to tell you the exact distance from you to the goal node, You can prove to yourself that you would never expand more than D number of nodes, where D is the depth to the goal. Because you'll never make any mistake. You know, people may try to mislead you, but you know exactly how far you're supposed to go, best path to the goal, and you know how far you have traveled, so you'll know exactly the path to take. But the point is, if I ask for that, I'm cheating, because how will I know exactly how far I have to go to the goal? So then I need to ask for estimates. Maybe I won't get the exact distance, exact best distance from B to G. I might tell you an estimate of distance from B to G.
On the map, you could use bird's eye distance.
Yeah, wait just a second. That's a very good point. Watch a second. So I will give you an estimate of distance from B to G. So an estimate can be a lower estimate or a higher estimate. Right? Upper bound or a lower bound. When I say it's an approximate distance from B to G is 20, let's say. I can say 20 is the lower bound. That means the distance is at least 20. The real distance is at least 20. Or I can say it's upper bound, where I'll say the real distance is at most 20. Suppose I'm going to tell you that either I can give you, here is a distance which is a lower bound. It's probably lower bound. Whenever I give you a distance using this estimate, it will be a lower bound on the real distance. And here is another distance that I'll give you, which is probably an upper bound on the distance. Which would you pick such that you would be guaranteed to get optimal node, optimal goal?
Lower bound.
Lower bound. And the way you can think about this is the following. You already got optimum uniform cost search, right? Uniform cost search is optimum. Right? You agreed with that. And it's using a bound. What is it bound about the rest of the cost? Zero. It's adding G plus zero, which is the total cost. So it's assuming that everybody's distance to the goal node is zero, in essence. And by assuming zero, and nothing can be less than zero, by assuming zero, which is a definite lower bound, it wound up being optimal. So even if you just do dimensionality analysis, extreme analysis, you can see that if you are lower than the true cost everywhere, then you will be optimal. If you are higher than the true cost anywhere, then you are no longer guaranteed to be optimal. And you said, you are the one who said, that if you are doing distances on the maps, you could do bird's eye view, which is actually the straight line distance between two points on a plane. That's for example. What is the good thing about straight line distance between two points on a plane? It's the shortest possible path. So in fact, I'm trying to get from here to that guy, you know, who's trying to sleep, right? And I can try to walk through the tables, which would actually be enough commotion that they will wake up, or, right, or I could actually try to follow, I mean, I can actually do the legal path, which is harder, which in fact I have to go through the entire room without running into anything. But whatever is the optimal path to go from here to there, I know that it's the straight line distance is going to be a lower bound.
Assuming your goal is shortest distance.
Yeah, no. You always look for the shortest cost. If you define cost as the distance to the goal, then you're thinking all in terms of cost. Okay, so so the two points I made are that you need the distance not only to this node, but an estimate of the distance from the current node to the goal node. Okay, and we will use this terminology. You already have G of N, which is the G value, the distance that you travel to go to that node from the root node, plus I'll assume that I have an estimate called H, the heuristic, of N, which gives me an estimate of the distance I still have to travel, the cost I still have to incur to go from N to the nearest goal.
Wait, real quick, just to clarify, when you say G of N and distance, you're referring to?
The cost. All of them are cost, yeah. Okay, so G of N is the total cost I incurred, cost until now. And this is cost to go, except if I know this, I always know. During search, I will know this perfectly. This I won't have perfect estimate. If I have perfect estimate on this, then there is no search. Well, there is search, but it's like child's play search. If I have an estimate of the cost to go, let's assume that the real cost to go is h star n, which is for each node, it's a function that tells you exactly how far that node is from the nearest goal node. What is the minimum amount of cost you need to go from that node to the nearest goal node. What I'm doing is an h of n, which is an approximation to h star of n. Okay? As long as h of n is a lower bound, that is, for all n, h of n is less than or equal to h star of n, I am guaranteed to get optimal solution. If, instead of prioritizing the queue using just g of n, I prioritize the queue with g of n plus h of n. So that's called f of n. I will make up another name called f of n. And f of n is g of n plus h of n. And I will prioritize the queue in terms of the f value. This is what is h star? H star is that perfect distance estimate, which you don't have. But if you can prove that the estimate you have is guaranteed to be less than the perfect distance estimate everywhere, without knowing what the perfect distance is, and that's possible, right? Without knowing exactly what is the optimal distance to everybody here, I know that whatever is the optimal distance, the straight line distance would be less than that. It's a for all proof. Once I have that kind of a heuristic, then I can use that with f of n, g of n plus h of n, prioritize the queue. This, by the way, is the A star search. That's all A star search is. What? Estimate?
Yeah.
Whenever you are in doubt, say that estimate can be zero. And it's easy. Estimate can be zero and uniform cost search. The question is, can you get better, closer and closer to H star N? So we started A star search today. Next class is fully about A star search. We will talk a lot about both the properties of A star, plus also how do you get heuristics? How do you get them as close to H star as possible, but not crossing them? Okay? That's it.